Are you guys fired up? Well, I just want to say what a great turnout. I'm Congressman Adam Kinzinger. I'm actually from your neighboring state of Illinois. Iowa, by the way, looks a lot like Illinois, and it's great to be here. Believe it or not, there are Republicans from Illinois, so yeah. Yeah, we got a Republican governor now. Oh, let me just say, you know, first off, I'll tell you just quickly how I got into politics. I was a military pilot. I still am. I fly for the Air National Guard. And I remember in May of 2009, I left Iraq and made the decision. I saw President Obama had been elected, and I made the decision at that time, you know what, we're in a pretty dark moment in history. There's a lot of concerns. There was talk about nationalized health care, which ended up happening. We had a debt and deficit spiraling out of control, and all these things were going on, and everybody was pessimistic, including me. I came back and decided to run for Congress, not because I was buried in the pessimism of the future of the country, but because I knew we'd have to go through some pretty tough years. But ultimately, America will do what America has always done, which is come out on the other side even stronger than we went in. That's why I defended my country in the military. That's why I ran for Congress, and that's why I continue to do what I do today. You know, it was about a year ago, I was taking a look just personally at who was talking about running for president of the United States, because there's no doubt in my mind that this is the most important election cycle, definitely in my short life of 37 years, but probably I'd say even longer than that. And one of the people that really stood out to me was a man named Jeb Bush. We all knew him, we had read about him, and we were excited about it, but I started to look at what the candidates were saying. And the thing that struck me about Governor Bush was he basically said, look, I'm going to tell y'all the truth. I'm optimistic. I believe in the future of this country. I believe that people that are born into poverty can find a way out and lift themselves to be as successful as everybody wants to be, because this is the greatest country in the world. And it struck me that in a time of kind of dark pessimism in this country, similar to 1979, by the way, when Jimmy Carter was president and all this stuff was going on, I realized that in this dark time, we need a leader who's not just going to reflect our anger back at us and make us even angrier, but who's going to understand that anger and show us a way out and show us a way ahead and show us how to leave our kids and grandkids a country even far better than the one we were amazingly blessed to inherit ourselves. And that man, by the way, was Governor Bush. And I saw that, and I fell in love with the message of optimism and the message of hope. And I was one of the first people to endorse him before he even announced for president. So it's a good thing he ran, or else I would have looked pretty stupid. But, you know, as a guy that still flies for the military and you know, works with very brave, honorable young men and women, the thing that strikes me is for 250 years, this country has put blood, sweat, toil, and many people have given their lives to make America what it is today. And there are some people that will have you to believe that 250 years of American history and that dream that has been amazing and been fulfilled, that God-given purpose that we have, somehow dies now. That America's best days are behind us. Everybody's stupid, everybody's dumb, and we may as well just accept that we were a nation of just good now and not any longer great. That's not true. The same American people that in 1979 heard an optimistic message of a shining city on a hill, of a purpose, when they were in double-digit interest rates, we had just left Vietnam. The Russians looked more powerful than ever. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? A guy named Ronald Reagan came along and compelled the American people to a vision of what they could achieve. Not because he especially said, I have amazing talents, but because he could compel people to that. And in 1989, as he's given his farewell address to the nation, everybody realizes one thing. He says, to paraphrase, I don't know if I ever quite described what I meant by a shining city on a hill, but what I meant was a kid graduating from high school or college and being able to provide for his family, being able to buy a house, an America that people that live behind the Iron Curtain of not just communism but poverty and everywhere else look at us as an inspirational hope of what they can achieve in sometimes hopeless countries. And what's amazing is he was given that speech. People realized, holy cow. In just 8 years, we accomplished everything he set out to accomplish. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in a tough time in our country right now, and we deserve way better than what we've been dealt for the last 7 years. And there is one man in this race that I believe in strong enough, that I believe in, that I believe has the optimism and the understanding of what's going on and what needs to be done, Ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud to endorse and I'm proud to introduce the next president of the United States, Governor Jeb Bush.
Thank you so much, Congressman. Thank you for campaigning with me all across this country. Adam's main job is to do the morning shows after the debates. Today was a little easier for him than the previous debates, I think. So thank you for your service. I've got. I wanted to recognize my two of my three children that I love more than I can describe to you. Jeb Jr., 2.0 as we call him, and Noelle, my daughter, is back there. I want to tell you two stories and then open it up. These are stories about leadership. When I announced my campaign, I wanted to talk about the things that are broken and how we can fix them so people can rise up again. And we began to get our tax on our country again, and national security has become more and more of an issue. Something that I think is important for us to talk about, because we can't restore economic growth unless we're secure as a nation. And today we see what happens when we pull back. Hillary Clinton believes that just a third term of the foreign policy of Barack Obama is okay, that we got ISIS right where we want them, that that the reset button with Russia was going to work out. As President Obama said, that Russia was just a regional power, not to worry. 30 days later, they invade Ukraine. We see this, the politics of grandiosity, of big language without backing it up, and our friends no longer believe we have their back, and our enemies no longer fear us. And we now are in a world that is far more dangerous than the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated. I got to give a speech at the Citadel, this military school in Charleston, South Carolina, and I laid out a vision for how we can restore America's presence in the world. It was a blast going to this place because the great majority of these students are going to go serve in the military, the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force, the Coast Guard. They're going to the school because they want to show their love of country. They're patriots. And I gave this speech, but before that I was required to go with the Summerall Guards, this elite group of cadets, at 6 a.m. for a little PT, they called it, physical therapy. And, I'm 62. I'm in pretty good shape for my age, but they're 21. So after about 50 sit-ups and 25 push-ups, I thought we were finished. Then we did more calisthenics. And then I thought we were finished. And they said, all right, we're going to go run in unison now for 3 miles. So when we finally finished, I played like it was no big deal. I was collapsing. But they circled around and they said, you want to be president. You want to be commander-in-chief. Well, you have my back. You're going to be president. What's America's role in the world? As commander-in-chief, will you defend and support the military? All the questions that you would expect someone about ready in the next 2 or 3 years to go serve in the military. Here's what I told them, and I told it in this speech. I will be a commander-in-chief that will respect the military. I won't impose political considerations on top of the warfighters. I'll get the lawyers off the backs of the warfighters, and when we fight, it should be in our own national security interests that we do it. I wear this band of Chris Horton, who died as a sniper in Afghanistan. I got it from his wife. To remind me that this is not, we're not talking about a video game here. The next president has to be serious, has to have a steady hand, has to understand that what we should achieve is peace through strength. Not to be a warmongering nation, not to be the world's policeman, but to create security for our own people, and therefore get back to the business of creating high sustained economic growth where people can rise up again. That's my mission, and I told them that, and they seem to appreciate it. Which means, by the way, we can't talk about it. We have to rebuild the military. We have seen through sequester, the so-called victory of having automatic cuts disproportionately on the military. The sequester, if continued on, will make the Army 420,000 troops. It will not send a signal of seriousness for the world. We need to get back to 490,000. We need to build the military, the Marines, back up to the levels of readiness. Half of the Marines that are stationed in the United States right now don't meet the definition of readiness. The Marines. We have an Air Force. Adam is a fantastic pilot. The Air Force, now he's young, don't get me wrong, but the Air Force, the planes are older than the pilots. The B-52 was launched during the era of Harry Truman. We've got to modernize our equipment. We need to increase the training. We need to be serious about making our national security our first priority, which means we have to deal with the new threats as well, the threat of terror. There is a threat that the president thinks needs to be dealt with as a law enforcement exercise, that somehow this is, they've declared war on us, but we can't even call it for what it is. It is Islamic radical terrorism. They're designing their activities to destroy Western civilization, to take away our freedom by attacking the vulnerability of our freedom. We need to be vigilant and strong, and we need to take out ISIS in the caliphate that it exists rather than playing defense here at home. That's what we need to do. And there's a strategy there as well. I hope you want a leader that has a steady hand, that knows what he doesn't know. Not on these debates, you hear people talk like they're just like it's a game. We're going to carpet bomb. Really? We're going to carpet bomb Mosul, a population of 800,000? You think ISIS is out in the desert somewhere? We can just carpet bomb people? We have to have a strategy where we're engaged, because without the United States, this will not happen. And I know how to do this, because frankly, I've had a front row seat on how it's done right. I'm proud of the fact that my dad was president of the United States and my brother was president of the United States. We know how to keep us safe. The second story, and then we'll open it up, is another story of leadership. And it's a story of being a governor. Governors have an interesting job. It's not like being president, but it is kind of like it, because you have to make tough decisions. When I was governor, we balanced the budget 8 years in a row without question. It was a requirement. There was no argument. We didn't create some artificial game. We balanced the budget. We lived within our means. The objective in Florida was that personal income would grow far faster than government income. And that's what we achieved. I was one of two states during my time to go from AA to AAA bond rating, because we applied conservative principles each and every day. We fully funded the pension. We didn't take non-recurring revenue to spend on recurring obligations. The way I viewed it was the budgeting process and how we went about our business was like a kitchen table budget. Not all this weird stuff that no one understands in the language. It was a simple thing. We were going to take in as much money as we needed to fund the principal obligations of government. We would cut taxes to give it back to the rest. $19 billion of tax cuts. When I left, there was $9 billion of reserves. They called me Vito Corleone because I vetoed 2,500 separate line items in the budget. Not because I wanted to be the big dog on the stage, you know, like Tarzan here. It was because there was a principle behind this. You can't just spend money you don't have. You have to live within the means of the people you're serving. In that kind of time as governor, I learned also that you can't just excuse away and talk away things when there's a challenge. Life doesn't work out as it's always planned, does it? Sometimes, you know, you have 8 hurricanes and 4 tropical storms in 16 months. That's what I had. We had $150 billion of insured and uninsured losses. We had over 1,200,000 homes that were uninhabited. We had people that were living paycheck to paycheck that no longer had anything. I'll never forget, I met a woman at the largest mobile home park in the world, Barefoot Bay it's called, in East Central Florida. And this place was devastated. These were manufactured homes. The storm went right through there. And this woman was wearing a Salvation Army sweatshirt, and she came and she just gave me a hug. And she didn't let go. She didn't let go. I mean, she just gave me a hug, and I just caressed her back, and just she was crying, and I was consoling her. And then I said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, I'm volunteering for the Salvation Army." I said, "Why?" "I lost everything. I felt it was the best way to give back." Man, there are thousands and thousands of stories during my time as governor where I led. I didn't talk about it. I did it. It's different when you're a governor, when you want to lead. It's not like filing an amendment and calling it a success. It's not about talking about it and changing your views when public sentiment changes. When you're a leader, you have a focus on moving towards the fire to take it out, to solve the problems. And that's what we need in Washington, D.C. right now. 8 hurricanes and 4 tropical storms taught me that you got to be all in the job. I had a countdown clock when I was governor in my second term, and it went backwards all the way to 0. I spent 4 years, my last 4 years, with the same passion and conviction that I had in my first 4 years, and we accomplished a lot. Because I had a servant's heart. Because when I saw a problem, I didn't say the dog ate my homework. It was somebody else's fault. Look at the shiny object and maybe it'll go away. I didn't blame Benghazi on a videographer and then lie to the family members. We need people that are leaders again to solve these problems, that will accept personal responsibility. And the first place we should do it is in the Veterans Administration. And I promise you, when I'm President of the United States, heads will roll out of that department until we get it right. Veterans deserve far better care than they're getting today. So if you're looking for someone who's got a proven record, a proven, consistent, conservative record across the board, whether it's the issues of life, which are not political to me, this is informed by my faith. I converted to Catholicism on Easter Sabbath in 1995. It was one of the great moments of my life to join the faith of my wife. Or the Second Amendment, or all the amendments, because they're all a package deal as far as I'm concerned. The Bill of Rights, protecting our Constitution. If you're looking for someone who believes in cutting taxes rather than raising taxes, of reforming the things that are broken, applying conservative principles of limited government, of personal responsibility, of individual liberty, if you're looking for someone who has that record and who can apply that those same principles with detailed plans to fix things, and if you're looking for someone with a servant's heart, who has a backbone and a heart for people, I hope you'll caucus for me at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., excuse me, don't go to 7 a.m., on Monday. I won't let you down. I'm running for president because I believe we're on the verge of the greatest time to be alive, and I want to fulfill what every generation has been able to fulfill, which is to provide opportunities for the next generation that are greater than what they had. We're on the verge of doing this, but we got to change direction of this country, and I think I can do it with you, and I hope that you'll join me. Thank you all very much. There's a mic. There's a, one mic, two mics, and one back there. Here's one. Here's a question right here.
As president, you'll have some openings on the U.S. Supreme Court. Yep. Will you consider a Barack Obama as a nominee?
Well, you've obviously been watching the Democratic debates. That was pretty breathtaking. Yeah. I would call, I'd put that in the pander category. No.
Thank you, Governor. What is your plan for providing safe, reliable, affordable energy in the future?
Well, I think we need to have a diversity of supply of energy. I think we ought to let markets decide this more than anything else. That, you know, we drove through here from Des Moines, and there's wind turbines all over the place. Today, you can build wind capacity at a rate that is competitive without a tax credit because there's been massive innovation. My guess is that ethanol will have the exact same, it already has seen reductions, that markets work. We shouldn't protect any source of energy because of the tax code, including the oil and gas sector, where my tax plan eliminates depletion allowances and all the special carve-outs and special treatment for every source of energy. I trust people sitting in a garage somewhere, probably a kid, hopefully living in Miami just because the wealth effect of these things are pretty extraordinary. Maybe it'll be here in Iowa. Someone's going to figure out how to have a sustainable, renewable source of energy that will defy the world. And my bet would be that it'll be an American. And my bet will be it will be more likely to happen in the freest possible kind of environment than one where you have a venture capital arm inside the Department of Energy. That worked out really well, didn't it? The old Solyndra bet worked out fantastic. And here's the other point I would make. Look, as a governor of the state of Florida, which has a very fragile environment, it's important to balance the economic interests of a state or a country with the environmental, of protecting Wild Florida. The question to me is that we need to be stewards of the environment. It's not just a political statement. It's a spiritual statement. And so whatever we do, we should make sure that we're not depriving people of economic opportunity along the way. And I think we can achieve this. This is an extraordinary country with innovative capability. The role of the government would be to invest in the long-term basic research to find the next disruptive technologies. I have a friend here from Florida who was born in Iowa, who served in the Florida Senate. And I thought Kurt, who was also probably the premier environmentalist in the public sector when I was serving, and maybe, Kurt, you have something to say?
Yes,
Kurt Kaiser.
I left Iowa in 1967 to go to Tallahassee, and that's where we wanted to live, was Florida. And so I have watched, and I got elected to the legislature 10 years in the state house, 10 years in the state senate. So I have watched all of the political leadership from the 1960s to current day. And for some people to think that you can compare Marco Rubio with Jeb is a joke. I'm telling you, the things that Jeb did, he talks about, that happened. I was involved. I was there. He did not exaggerate one bit on what he said his record was all about in Iowa. But let me just give you a couple facts. In 1998, the Florida legislature, both House and Senate, for the first time since the Civil War, went Republican. So we've had Republican speakers of the House and presidents of the Senate every year since 98. Marco Rubio was one of those speakers. Every single one of those Republican speakers, except Rubio, have all endorsed Jeb. He's the only one in that whole group, because he's for himself, obviously. And if you look at the number of legislators that are in office today, 40 in the Senate and 120 in the House, about two-thirds of all Republican legislators have endorsed Jeb over Marco. That's because they have seen firsthand Jeb's record.
Yes, sir. I thought I was going to talk about environmental policy, but that's okay. Thank you. We're learning this in the debates, too.
All right. I'm a newlywed.
Congratulations.
Thank you. My wife and I, we just got out of school, college, that is. And right now we're struggling to be able to pay back, obviously, the student loans and then American Dream to own a house. So if you get elected, when you get elected, what will you do to help in my situation, you know, to pay off the student loan and to be able to afford a house? And
how much is your, just generally, how big is the student loans that you and your wife have?
Combined, probably near 80,000, 90,000 with interest, you know, so 9% maybe.
This is one of the tragedies of this is part of the legacy of Obamacare. The federal, you know, the nationalization of the student loan program happened with Obamacare. It's doubled in size, $1.2 trillion of debt, $1.2 trillion. And the forbearance rates, the default rates are growing, and this is recourse debt. This debt has to be paid off before you make your car loan or anything else, pay off your credit card. And it's a burden on young people particularly that's extraordinary. A week ago, I outlined a end of the student loan program to start with for everybody going forward. Because I don't think it's the proper place for government to act. If there's a private loan market, fine. I mean, I don't care about that at all. But ending the student loan program and replacing it with an income repayment plan where everybody that graduates from college would get a $50,000 line of credit. And if they borrowed it, not just for an AA degree or AS degree or a four-year degree or master's degree, but also for certificates. You can get a certification that you're, you know, that you can work on Oracle, and you immediately get a job as an information technologist. If you want to get a certificate that shows that you're a welder, I promise you, you get a job like that. At a wage, by the way, far higher than many of the four-year degree jobs that people get, which are below, you know, that they can't get a job. Psychology is the number one degree program for four-year degrees in the universities in this country. It's a fine degree. But there aren't any openings for psychologists. Many times you have to go to get a master's, indebting yourself more. So the net effect of this is opening up options, apprenticeships, and others where the people can make decisions about what they want to do, and you pay it back 1% per $10,000 of money borrowed. It's not a loan. It's you're basically, the government is investing in your future. And for a 25-year period, up to the time when you pay it off, up to a cap of 1.75, you would pay it back 1% per $10,000 borrowed right out of your tax return. No filling out all those crazy forms, none of the complex bureaucracy. That's number one, the first part of this. Secondly, this would force universities to lower their prices rather than raise their prices because they're financing their higher costs on you, on your back. Well, Who said that's a great idea? Why do we have in higher education inflation, in effect, that's higher 5x more than regular inflation, 10x more? Tuition grows at 6, 7, 8% in most states, and inflation is growing at 1 or 2%. It's because we're financing their lack of accountability on the backs of people that are trying to get an education. Third, there should be a total transparency about what the benefits of the degree you're pursuing are before you start, and some understanding of what it takes to get that degree. And universities need to open up classrooms more. Professors need to teach more. A four-year degree ought to be completed in 4 years, for crying out loud. They measure degree completion rate for full-time students in 6 years. Well, call it a six-year degree and be honest, or do it in 4 years and be real. So that's the third part. And the final part of this is there ought to be skin in the game. The universities, if they don't fulfill their part of the bargain, if you can't get a job for the degree that, you were expecting, and it costs you $60,000, $70,000 as a couple, they ought to have, some of that money ought to be held back. The universities ought to have to pay it back to the students that borrowed this money. They should have skin in the game. Those things would lower tuition costs. You know why I know this? Because in Florida, the lowest tuition in public in-state students in the country when I left was Florida. You could go to the University of Florida or FSU and not pay tuition at all, because we thought that was a value of importance. So our lottery monies go to something called the Bright Futures Scholarship Program. We have a Florida prepaid program that's by far and away the largest in the country. There are people invest over the long haul to give their children and grandchildren a chance to go to, go to college. We challenge, now we have accountability in our higher education. They have to compete for the dollars the state provides. And if they don't get their degree completion rates up, they don't get the money. Guess what? Degree completion rates go up. That's how life works, right? Accountability around universities and not having all this financed on the backs of young people has to be the first priority. I can tell you, that is not an aberration, that question. I get that question in every town hall meeting two or three times. And it is a disgrace that we've allowed our government just run wild on this at the expense of students. Anybody back there? Excuse me. Yes, you're back there. That works.
In Iowa, we know the Bush as well. How would you say you are most similar to your father and brother, whom we came to know and many of us voted for?
What? How are you most similar to them, and how are you most different from them?
Wow. I'm much better looking than my brother. I mean, come on. My dad, compare it, I'll tell you what, when I was in my mid-20s, the two things that have really transformed my life, made my life, is marrying my wife. I met her when I was 17 in Mexico, and it was love at first sight. And my life can be divided between BC and AC, before Columba and after Columba. I was much better after Columba. I got out of school in 2 years, and I've worked, and she's been my inspiration and motivation. The other inspiration in my life has been my dad. And he's 91. He is near perfect in my mind. So how can I compare myself to the person who I consider to be my hero and the greatest man alive? I mean, I'm going to get emotional about this. That's not my problem. How do I compare myself to a guy who joined the Navy, was the youngest Navy pilot in World War II history, got his wings when he turned 19, was shot down in the Pacific, and barely escaped being picked up by the garrison at Chichijima Island. And had he been picked up, he would have been in a war camp where the commander of that camp was executed for war crimes for cannibalism with prisoners. I mean, my dad's life experience is so full, so rich, so big. When I was in my 20s, you know, normally when you have a father that you've just idolized and has had this success and never cursed, never raised his hand to me, just perfect, I figured, you know what, normally you try to get to be like your father, you know, if I could just be like him, I figured if I could just be like half of him. It was a perfect decision on my part because that lower expectation allowed me to live my own life. And my life is different. I married a girl from León, Guanajuato, Mexico. I moved to Florida, away from Texas. I've worked my entire, I mean, we started having children when we were young. I got married when I was 21. I lived in Venezuela. I've lived a very different life than my brother, and my life experiences are, I'm not saying they're better or worse, they're different, and we're different because of that. I'm probably more, he's more disciplined, more focused. I'm probably a little more cerebral, which I'm trying to, you know, work on. I've got a little therapy on that. I don't want to be overly wonkish here, but I love ideas. I love policy. I look like my mother. He looks like his dad. I don't know what else. I mean, I admire George's fortitude, his dogged determination when we were under attack. To me, that was inspiring. The fact that he went against popular will to create the surge, along with extraordinary group of men and women in uniform that left Iraq with mistakes made along the way, but they left Iraq in a secure place, fragile but secure. And it was because of his dogged determination to finish what was started. And I admire that as well. And I've learned just by having a front row seat, watching them work. And the final thing I'd say is, look, 2017 is going to be a lot different than 1989. You know, Adam talked about the age of Reagan. I was thinking about it. Adam, you were one. Speaking so eloquently about the time of 1980. You know, every election, every circumstance is different, right? The context is always different. But we can always learn from the lessons of history, and we can learn from successes. My best lessons for me personally have been the ones where it didn't work, where I didn't succeed, where I had to dust myself off, where I made a mistake. I mean, isn't that how life works for you all? If you've lived a life where you've learned through trial and error, through living a life, being active, being engaged, you're a lot better on that journey by taking the time to listen to yourself and to challenge yourself along the way. And I think you want a president that actually has had a little adversity in their life as well, a fuller, deeper understanding of how people are challenged today. And I think I'm your guy in that regard. So I don't know if that's different, the same. I'm Jeb, and I'm a proud. I'm Jeb! Exclamation point! Proud to be a Bush.
Us are pretty cool with another Bush in the White House, and most of us are not very cool with another Clinton in the White House. What makes you best prepared to accomplish that?
Say the last part.
What makes you best equipped to accomplish that?
Very good question. And in fact, that is a, you want to have someone that can actually serve. That's important. But you also want to have someone who can win, because all the rest of this is jibber jabber if that doesn't happen. Here's what I believe to be true. I believe having someone who has been thoroughly vetted, 34 years of tax returns. Because of my circumstance, I can promise you everything I've done has been vetted. Everything. I was governor of a big state, but back to the Bush thing, you know, a lot of ways that you try to hurt my dad would be to expose something I might have done or something like that. I've been thoroughly vetted, and I've been totally open. I gave out 330,000 emails during my time as governor related to my work. You can go to jebemails.com, and you can pick them up. You can see every email that is there. I wrote a book called Reply All, which is a book about my service during those 8 years. Compare that to the way the Clintons roll. You got to get a subpoena to get her emails. 34 tax years of tax returns, it's out there. Whatever they're going to find, they're going to find I paid my taxes. Got an effective tax rate that's in the 30s, not in the 6s, you know, or 10 or whatever. So I think first, having a proven record of accomplishment, being thoroughly vetted is second, and campaigning with a hopeful, optimistic message with your arms wide open. We're never going to win as conservatives if we're the reactionary party. We win like Reagan won, with a hopeful, optimistic message that is firm and resolute, but also encourages people to join our team. Last night in the debate, it was interesting. There was this beautiful girl on YouTube. I don't know if you saw the debate that they showed on the screen, these YouTube entrepreneurs. I mean, they have millions of people following them on YouTube. And she served in the military, and she's now a fashion designer, I think, on YouTube. Extraordinary business. And she basically was saying, can I join you? And the same with the woman who was Muslim. Basically saying, you know, am I wanted? Am I wanted on your team? And the questions were answered by other people, and they didn't answer it the right way. And so I butted in. Yeah, yeah, you want it. Of course we want you on our team. We want every person that has a big dream to be a conservative. We want all God's children to be on our team. We're not going to exclude anybody. Our message is one of hope and optimism. And I think that's how you win. And you take it to her. You take it to her. Look, she'll talk about early childhood education, how it's important. And she's got the endorsement of the teachers union. They'll be trotted out. Basically, she'll want to expand government-run 4-year-old programs, you know, pre-K programs. I've done something different. In Florida, we have 80% of all 4-year-olds in literacy-based programs, 90% of which are churches and synagogues and private settings. And we benchmark it, and we do it a half a day rather than a full day. And it's effective, and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. And our learning gains are the highest for 4-year-olds or 4th graders in the country. A state with 57% of our students, 4-year-olds, qualified for free and reduced lunch, basically living near or at the poverty level. 57 or 56% of our students are minority students. I won't be lectured to by Hillary Clinton or anybody on the left about how we can create upward mobility for people that are stuck in poverty and how the middle class can't earn any money that need to be more dependent upon government. I can take it to her because I have a proven record as governor of the state of Florida to create 4.4% income growth each and every year I was governor. Yeah, others will talk about it. They'll say they'll do it. I've done it. I think that's the far better way to take it to Hillary Clinton. Yep. And by the way, if you think that the back and forth in this primary campaign is tough, first of all, I don't know. I mean, I've been around a lot of campaigns. It's beanbag so far. I just don't find it that negative. You don't think the Clinton hit machine, once they get going? I hope you want someone who has been thoroughly vetted and thoroughly scrutinized, because we can't afford to lose this election, because they'll be coming at whoever our nominee is with a vengeance. There's no hope and optimism in the Clinton message. I can promise you that. Her first impulse when asked in a debate who her enemies were, she said the NRA, the drug companies, the standard things. And then she said, but you know what? Really, the real enemy that I have are Republicans. This is not going to be morning in America here. This is going to be bam, bam, bam. And we better be ready to fight back with someone who's been tested, because it'll get ugly quick. Yes, sir. The what? Illegals?
We could stop the ones from Mexico. What are we going to do with the ones coming over from the Middle East?
Well, if you're talking about the refugees, I don't think we should allow refugees in until the FBI director can make a clean assertion that the vetting process reflects the new reality that embedded in these refugee populations, at least going to Europe, are people who are professing jihad against Western civilization. They should not be allowed to come in. And now, having said that, the main way to deal with this threat is to take out ISIS in the caliphate. We can't play defense, and we can't close down our country. Ultimately, for this to be successful, we need to destroy ISIS in the caliphate the size of Indiana with 40,000 battle-tested terrorists. Their existence is a victory for them because it allows them to recruit. In the last year, there have been, in 17 countries, 70 attacks outside the caliphate that were either ISIS-inspired or ISIS-controlled. And that will grow. And it'll grow in Asia, it'll grow in Africa, it'll grow in the Middle East, and it's going to grow here, as we saw in San Bernardino. So, the best way to solve the refugee problem is to embed our troops with the Iraqi military, to arm the Kurdish Peshmerga forces with better, more sophisticated equipment, to reestablish the partnership with the Sunni tribal leaders that ultimately is going to create the stability once ISIS is gone, that helped us with the surge, that gets the warfighters, gets the lawyers off the warfighters' backs, that deals with a no-fly zone in Syria and safe zones in Syria so the refugees can stay there, and we can build this army financed by the Arab world in partnership with them and with Europe to take out ISIS at its core. That's how you deal with this problem and be serious about it. Yes, sir?
Are you saying we should put a stop on the Muslims until Donald Trump's?
No, I don't. So if you want to guess, I just, as part of that strategy, just describe the Peshmerga, the Kurds. They're Muslim. So we're going to tell the Muslims, who are the strongest allies, strongest admirers of the United States, sorry, we want you to fight this fight, and we'll give you arms, but you can't come to our country to talk about it. Or the Indonesians. The largest Muslim population are not in the Middle East. Indonesians, Indians, Pakistanis. If you send a signal that you're going to ban all Muslims, you're sending a signal that the United States is retreating in the world. It's not the Muslims that's the problem. It's radical Islamic jihadists that are the problem. And we have to have the ability to distinguish between the two, or we're going to create more jihadists. We're going to push Muslims away at a time when we need them to be part of this. The United States can't deal with this in isolation of the world. In fact, we can lead it, but we have to have Muslims fighting this fight in Syria and in Iraq. We can't do it in abstention or just in isolation of them. So, no, I don't agree with that. I think it would be bad for our national security interests to do that. And that means that we need to defend the homeland better and all the things that I do think are important. But we have to engage in the world. We can't just pull back and think that's going to work. Oh. I have a big cough and I'm losing my voice, and that made it a little bit harder. I've been speaking louder than I needed to. Is that right? Yes.
How do you plan to fix the gridlock in Washington?
So the gridlock in Washington, it's interesting. I mean, we're 240 years old as a country. We've had gridlock in the past. I mean, we've had duels. So sometimes they've taken it more seriously than we do now. But most of the time, this democracy is function. Why? Why is it now so different? Well, I think we have a president whose first impulse is to push down anybody that disagrees with them, to make them look bad, to create a straw man, to demonize them because his nuanced, sophisticated view hasn't been adhered to, that somehow, if you don't agree with him, you're a bad person. Your motivations are wrong. I would start with the premise that people that disagree with me might just be wrong. It's not that they have bad motives. They're not bad people. They might be liberal, or they might have a view about America's role in the world that's different than mine. If you start with the premise that people aren't bad people because they disagree with you, you can begin to rebuild the trust. And the next president better start doing that, because this whole idea of pushing someone down to make yourself look better, I don't know, back to the Bush family. Barbara Bush, when she saw a kid in our family act like that, you know what happened? They didn't have a child, you know, when they had her hotline for child abuse. I mean, we gotta get back to grown-up world here, where you don't assume people are bad. You forge consensus. You know something about them. You build trust. And when you agree, at least, you go to yes, right? I mean, right now, even when they agree on subjects, mental health is a big challenge in our country today, and we're underfunding mental health. We need to figure out better ways to deal with the challenges of gun violence, where people just are deranged and they end up making these killing innocent people. It's not the law-abiding citizens, not the gun owners are the problem here. It's a mental health challenge, and identifying those people is people on the right and left agree. The president's first impulse is to use executive authority he doesn't have to try to solve this problem, to make a political point, a political argument. I'll be a president that, A, will not blame my predecessor. I don't know, first 3 or 4 years, it was hard to watch TV. I won't blame my predecessor. I'll accept personal responsibility. I'll be held accountable. And I won't assume that people are bad people because they disagree with me. That's how you begin to reweave a degree of civility that allows you to move forward. Then, and it's not a violation of principle, by the way, to try to do that. Who came up with that idea? And who came up with the idea that it's a sign of strength getting nothing done? I mean, think about this. We're in this Alice in Wonderland logic now that is totally bizarre. We have a tax code where businesses are being bought by foreign companies, relocating the smaller businesses, buying the big U.S. business, relocating outside the country. We're losing the taxes, and we're losing the jobs. And everybody says it's a problem, but no one has a solution. Of course we have a solution. Fix it. Move to a territorial tax code like every other country has. Allow for one-time monies to come back into the country for the $2 trillion of cash that's sitting overseas. Turn this on its back and turn inversions into reinversions back into our own country. There's solutions to every one of these problems, but you got to start with the premise that you're not the end-all and be-all. You're not the big dog on the stage. You have to have a servant's heart to be able to forge consensus. And governors know how to do this, because we have to. Yes, sir.
Would you be willing to make a commitment to what you just said, to whoever your future opponent might be when it comes to the general election, that you will, as a matter of fact, say that they are indeed people with the best of intentions and not just the punchline of a joke?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's tougher with Hillary Clinton because of the trust issue.
Well, then especially, will you give Hillary Clinton?
But I'll do it right now. I give her respect of being intelligent, of knowledgeable, policy-oriented. She has a set of detailed plans that are very different than mine. But she's, you know, she's sincere in that regard. She believes what she believes. I can't give her credit for honesty and trustworthiness because... Look, when you tell family members who lost their loved ones that it was a videographer that was the motivation for the attack in Benghazi, which she said, and then you're under oath, and you say, well, and there's emails, because the only reason we know this is that her emails were subpoenaed by the FBI. They weren't voluntarily given, as she said. And then it turns out that she had emailed her daughter on her private server about classified information and to the Prime Minister of Egypt that this was motivated by jihad. Under oath she says that. To the family she said something different. That's just not trustworthy. I mean, I can't admire that, but I can admire her intelligence, her focus, her command of policies. I can certainly do that. But hope you give me a little break here, that as it relates to trustworthiness and honesty, she's got a long way to go to not just who cares what I think in this regard. She's having a hard time in the Democratic primary, and she would have a hard time with the American people restoring some degree of trust just because of her history. Yes?
So you talk about the massive modernization of the military. You briefly talked about the Air Force and planes and stuff. How is that all going to be funded and all the care of veterans and stuff? How is that going to be funded?
So, great question. Let me pull out my prop here for a second. This is, I don't know how many of these we have here, but this is a blueprint for all the ideas that we've laid out. And you can go to jeb2016.com and drill down. And part of this is everything that we've done, whether it's preserving and protecting Social Security and creating a new system that will be viable for the next generation, or the reforms of Medicaid, Medicare, I mean, everything, including defense, we've priced it out. I've tried to be intellectually honest. And what I propose would be a $25 billion to $30 billion increase in spending, defense spending, per year. So it's a sizable commitment, but if you're going to rebuild the Navy, rebuild the Air Force, modernize and train and have a readiness factor that everybody expects we have, but we don't, it's going to cost more money. And that's the amount of money that would be spent. And in the case anybody's asking, where else should we be spending money? We should be spending, in my mind at least, more money on basic research, whether it's the NIH or the next generation of energy or the space program, that these long-term projects for America, I think we should be spending more money on. Where should we be spending less? We should spend by reforming Medicaid alone. Medicaid this year is going to grow by 18%. 18%. It is a massive increase because it's never been reformed. If you block granted that back to the states at CPI, based on the 10-year projection of spending, you would save $130 to $150 billion just in that 10-year period. And Medicare would be something similar based on the proposal we've laid out. So entitlements is where you're going to see savings, not because we're taking benefits away. We're just we're modernizing. We're bringing it into the 21st century. And we're allowing for the savings to accrue because their projected rates of growth are like 8% per year. And that compounding takes out all the other spending that is necessary, and the long-term things are being hurt because of it. So that's the Bush plan, and I believe it's financeable by higher growth, by reforming entitlements, by challenging the career civil service system that exists that creates lifetime employment for federal workers that no private sector workers get. They get 40% more pay for like-kind work in the private sector, And if you reform that and you had attrition allowing for a reduction in the number of federal workers, you could save a tremendous amount of money. One more, and then we got to go.
Okay. What can you do about
the Social Security cuts coming in 2017?
Well, the big cuts are going to be in about 10 years when it we completely run out of money, and when it goes bankrupt, then it's a 30% reduction. The cuts you're referring to, I think, are the CPI freezing the benefits rather than have it go up by CPI. I don't think there's a cut in 17.
Yeah, there is. They say some of us can lose up to 50% of our income from it.
I think that's probably 10 years out, but I may be wrong. I'm pretty sure that's 10 years out. Here's my plan real quick. For everybody that's on Social Security, there'd be no cuts. It exists as is. For starting in 2022, you would raise the retirement year, you would raise the retirement age by 1 month per year. So in 30 years' time, you get up to 70 for retirement, and early retirement would be 65. You would front load, you would back load the benefits. Right now, basically, the better deal is to retire early rather than retire late. Our proposal does the opposite, that the benefits, not cutting benefits, but you're blending the benefits differently so that late retirement has a better deal in terms of your beginning payment than early retirement. You would provide a minimum benefit for everybody of 120% of the poverty level. Today, on average, that's about 80% of the poverty level. Social Security was designed to be a supplemental insurance plan, a savings plan. It's now the principal source of savings for most seniors. And so having a floor that is higher than what exists now, I think, is appropriate. And then we would lower the benefits for people of higher income. You do all those things together and a few other things, you make it solvent. And it's reality-based. It's an approach that both left and right hopefully would agree on. For those that are working, that are retirement age and work because they want to or because they have to or both, we would say for you would not have to pay the employee portion of the of your payroll tax, which goes into Social Security. So why would someone 67, 68 years old who's retired already, why would they have, they shouldn't have to continue to pay into the system. They should be able to keep that money as part of their savings, as part of their retirement. That's the plan that we've laid out. That would, based on the actuaries that looked at this, that would save Social Security for another 50 years. And, you know, we better get on with it. The idea that the left always has this idea, don't worry, it'll work. It's like, anybody remember Alfred E. Newman, Mad Magazine? What me worry? It's just like, it'll all, you know, denial's a river in Africa. There's no problem here. It's just, it'll, nothing, you know, it'll all magically be fixed. It won't be fixed. It's not going to exist for anybody under the age of 50. That's what's going to happen if we don't move forward, because when it started, we had about 30 people working for one retiree. Then it went down to 10. Then it went down to 5. Now it's close to 3. And if nothing changes, it could literally get to 2-1 50 to 60 years from now. That's just, you know, that's impossible. That's not going to work. So there are solutions to the problems we face, but it requires a leader that recognizes it, that's reality-based, that has ideas, that are embedded in conservative principles, that has the ability to persuade people this has to happen and sticks with it, that shows dogged determination. And that's why I'm running for president. That's why I hope you'll caucus for me on Monday night. Thank you all very much.